Today in Studio 360, the writer William T. Bowman has always looked for his stories in dark and extreme places. War zones in the Balkans, the frozen desolation north of the Arctic Circle, among the addicts and hookers of San Francisco's Tenderloin District.
The more intensely people live, and often that means desperately, the more interesting their stories are, at least to me.
Bowman talks about his new novel and his one regret. Plus, what do all creative people have in common?
We all start our projects on day one with the same feeling of excitement. And on day two, we all look at what we did on day one and we all hate ourselves. Like, that's universal.
Elizabeth Gilbert on how to keep working through day three and day four and day five and beyond. All that and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But to start the show, the annual anthology Best American Poetry is a big deal in the world of MFA programs and writers' retreats, in other words, among poets. But since it started a quarter century ago, it hasn't really made that much of a splash in the wider culture until last week. When the latest edition of Best American Poetry came out, it included a poem by a writer called Yifeng Zhou. And called is the right verb because in the author's biography, it was revealed that Yifeng Zhou is a nom de plume of a white guy named Michael Derek Hudson. Hudson explained that he sent in the poem under a pseudonym to the magazine that had published it only after it had been rejected 40 times under his actual name. The internet naturally and understandably exploded with outrage. The poet and writer Jenny Zhang has an essay on BuzzFeed explaining why she and so many people were so upset by this deception, and she is here to talk about it. Jenny, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
So the anthology's editor, the Native American writer Sherman Alexie, wrote a long blog post explaining that he did indeed give this poem closer consideration because he wanted to include more non-white writers in the book. And 40% of the poems in his Best American Poems are by people of color. Mm. That's a good thing, right?
I think so. I mean, the historical legacy of Best American Poetry is that they've had very few editors who are not white. They've had very few instances where they've selected poems by non-white poets that were considered the best.
Right.
So the fact that we finally have one person who is willing to sort of explicitly say, I did care about that and I did care about finding diverse poets, that's really exciting. And it sucks that it's marred by him being tricked, I guess, by this person.
Yeah. Michael Derek Hudson didn't respond to our requests for comment, but it seems this was not a project by him to expose affirmative action. He just thought it would help him get published, which it did, apparently not in just this one instance, which makes him kind of pathetic and creepy, in my opinion. But do you think it has larger ramifications beyond this one odd guy?
You know, Michael Derek Hudson is not the first person to slip into the identity of a person of color to give himself some perceived advantage or edge. But the only difference is he can slip back into his life and not, you know, walk around in this world as a person of color who endures racism.
You write in the piece that when you were in creative writing graduate school at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, that some of your fellow students would say, oh, Jenny, you're so lucky not to be white. You're so lucky to be Asian. Really? They did that?
Yeah, they would say, you're lucky to be young. Young Asian, female writing about, you know, sort of sexy subjects. I think that my cohorts did perceive me as someone who had an advantage because I had something edgy about me, which was just simply, you know, my existence. You know, it's weird for me to say I've been so lucky when I can't go into a bookstore and have more than five choices if I want to, you know, read something that might interest me about Asian American characters. It's weird for me to connect sort of this moment where I do feel like there is a curiosity and a real need to make up for the insanely long drought where we haven't paid attention to excellent writers of color and excellent artists of color. And sort of what's actually happening, which is the New York Times is not reviewing books written by non-white people. You know, things are not actually changing. So when people are so envious of what I could have, it's really about, you know, what they think I could have, not what I do have.
Right. Yes. I mean, the idea that white people feel like victims in any sense is just insane. But
it makes sense.
But as it seems to me, in this long, gawky, awkward transition toward a more just society, stuff like this is going to happen.
Sure, all
and,
the time.
You know, Sherman Alexie was trying to do the right thing.
Right.
This weirdo was trying to game the system. whatever. I'm not sure. It's necessarily an expression of what's wrong. Rather, it's an expression of the awkward process of getting to a better place, maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, thank you for coming in and talking.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jenny Zhang is the author of the poetry collection Dear Jenny, We Are All Fine.
This is Emmy, and this is television's most exciting and glamorous night.
This weekend is the 67th annual Emmy Awards. They're meant to honor the best in television.
And the Emmy goes to...
Occasionally, they get it right.
Breaking Bad.
And sometimes they get it so wrong, like never giving one to Deadwood or The Wire. The Emmys are best, of course, when they recognize shows and people who are breaking new ground, which is one of the reasons I'm looking forward to watching this weekend. It seems hard to believe this is true, but this could well be the first year ever that an African-American woman wins the Emmy for Best Actress in a Drama Series. Viola Davis, the star of How to Get Away with Murder, and Taraji P. Henson of Empire are both up for the award. And Candy Alexander is up for Best Supporting Actress for Scandal.
Oh, please do, baby. Please take a stab at me. I wonder which one of us is faster.
When Hilton Hall's guest hosted Studio 360 a year ago, Alexander told him exactly who deserves the major credit for this late-breaking change.
Thank God for Shonda.
That's the TV creator Shonda Rhimes.
Thank God for Shondaland, because it's really outrageously wonderful to look up when you're driving down Sunset Boulevard and see a billboard with Viola Davis on it, only Viola, singular, and then drive a few blocks further and see a billboard with only Kerry Washington on it, singular.
That's right.
Now, this is the first time this has happened in my lifetime, and it's not a little thing. It's not a little thing for a little black girl to see that.
One of the things that made The Wire so great was its multiple points of view, the way it depicted people on all sides of urban messes. Almost nobody a totally good guy or bad guy, criminals and cops and journalists and politicians. Since that show went off the air in 2008, I hadn't seen another with such wide frame focus and sympathy about how the urban system works and fails until John Ridley's American Crime came along this spring. And on primetime network television.
I certainly thought it was very interesting that a broadcast network wanted to try to tackle these subjects. And I came back and I pitched to them the concept of doing it through the eyes of the families of the victims, the families of the accused. People caught up in something and trying to find a way to navigate probably the most desperate situation that you could ever have.
John Ridley's American Crime is up for Best Writing and Outstanding Limited Run Series. The Wire also inspired another Emmy-nominated project that's got nothing to do with crime or cops, Frances McDormand's miniseries Olive Kittredge.
I watched all 5 years in 2 months, and it completely transformed my idea of long-format television.
Absolutely.
And how that could really be available to telling female stories.
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Olive Kittredge is about people living in a small town on the coast of Maine. McDormand produced the miniseries. She's also up for an Emmy for her starring role as Olive, a wife, mother, and math teacher who is not an easy person to love.
What's depression?
It's bad wiring. Makes your nerves raw.
Is that why you're so mean all the time?
Absolutely.
Your mother is not depressed.
Yes, I am. Happy to have it. Goes with being smart.
It's an honest and unglamorous look, rare in television or movies, at a woman who starts out over the hill at 45 and gets older and older as the series goes on.
What I was really interested in the storytelling of Olive Kittredge was kind of a generational thing for me as a privately as a woman and also as a feminist who is 57 years old and has watched woman's place in society and domestically change since my mother's generation.
And I guess we can't get away from The Wire when we're talking about good TV. Reg E. Cathy, who played Norman Wilson on that show, is up for an Emmy for his role on House of Cards as the barbecue restaurant owner Freddie Hayes. But we think Reg deserves some special recognition for his role last year on Studio 360.
First, you must train your cat to use a homemade cardboard litter box if you have not already done so. Be sure to use torn up newspaper, not kitty litter. Stop using kitty litter.
That is Reggie Cathy as Charles Mingus reading The Catalog, which is, yes, a guide to toilet training your house cat, written by the legendary jazz composer and bassist Charles Mingus.
Do it gradually.
We've got a video at studio360.org. You can also hear the full conversations with Frances McDormand, John Ridley, and Candy Alexander, as well as with Kevin Spacey, Jessica Lange, Adam Driver, Lisa Kudrow, and many more 2015 Emmy nominees. Coming up,
the only reason I've been able to write and publish and release 7 books into the world is because there came a point in each one where I was like, ah, screw it, it's good enough.
Eat, pray, love, and chill. Liz Gilbert, anti-perfectionist. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Since the beginning of the year, we've been following 4 listeners who made their creative New Year's resolutions for 2015 at the beginning of the year. One of them is Garmin Herigstad. He lives in Bellingham, Washington. He'd made a career doing special effects for big-budget Hollywood movies, but this year he wanted to get back into his first handmade love, calligraphy. He resolved to hand-letter the entire biblical book of Proverbs.
Let me show you some of those.
He started strong, but it's been a bit more of a challenge than he expected.
With the Proverbs project, it's so big that if I were to do, you know, perfectly lettered things, I would probably make so many mistakes and do it over and over and over again. And so technology can fix some of that. It's cheating according to my original idea, but as I've been working at it, I think it's practical. I think maybe trying to escape away from technology for a while made me appreciate it more. There was some Proverbs advice that I wish I would have heeded a little bit more when I was in my early 30s and I was making buku bucks and maybe I was hanging out at too much late night and drinking a bit too much. And my wife wanted to get a divorce. And when I read through Proverbs, I'm kind of like, yeah, I should have known better. and so I realized, like, for me, like you know, maybe sin is something God doesn't want us to do just because we get hurt. And that's it. He just doesn't want us to get hurt. When I started the Proverbs Project, I really wanted to build up my lettering skill. My goal wasn't to produce an entire 30 chapters that looked beautiful. My goal was to go through the entire 30 chapters, and then by the end, hopefully, it will look good. And so that maybe by the time I get to the end, I can start and do it over again.
That was Garmin Herigstad. You can see some of his work, which is really pretty amazing, at studio360.org. Thanks to Audrey Quinn, who produced that story. Last month, we introduced a redesign project that has, so far, been a bit controversial, which we entirely expected. As people across the South have taken down the Confederate battle flag this summer, we wondered if there could be some new iconography that would celebrate the South without being hateful. So as part of our Studio 360 redesign series, we put the challenge to designers at the Dallas firm 70KFT. They were gathered in the office war room on the 30th floor of a building in downtown Dallas, staring at a wall plastered with ideas.
The wall is covered with, gosh, I'm looking at probably about, 50 different designs printed off on the color printer. And each one is affixed to the wall with a round metal magnet.
The images aren't really cliche Southern snapshots. No pictures of biscuits and gravy. No pecan trees dripping with Spanish moss. No magnolias. Although all those ideas were tossed around. And the designers have split into two teams. Designers Renee Nelson and Michael Favel are working on one stream of thought.
I've experienced the South my whole life. What are the thoughts? What are things? And what are we labeled as? We can be labeled very negatively, slow or simple. And the word rebel came to mind. I was like, well, that's not necessarily something that can be labeled as negative.
Okay, so with the rebel team, we are pushing for trying to take the name back, take the rebel name back. Because a rebel is kind of like, it could be anything. It could be bad, it could be good, but we're just taking it back for the good side.
The war room wall is split into two. The rebel ideas happen to be on the right side of the wall.
So what we're seeing here is the word rebel in the handwriting of Martin Luther King.
That's the founder and head of the firm, Gus Granger.
It started with it just looking at it on black, and then Alex went and we did these overlays of, these other Southern rebels that we, have falling into the category. We've got Truman Capote, we've got Jackie Robinson, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, Muhammad Ali, Mark Twain.
His creative director, Stefan Reddick, has a grammatical question.
Well, it's interesting, too. Did y'all look at capitalizing the R? Because right now I can misinterpret that as being rebel, or is it actual rebel?
Yeah,
is the rebel itself, a proper noun,
right,
or is it a comma?
In case you didn't catch that, y'all, Reddick grew up in Georgia. His approach to a new icon doesn't incorporate letters, but maybe needle and thread.
I'm on Team Quilt, which doesn't sound quite as cool as Team Rebel. We are starting to explore what the togetherness aspects kind of mean. We started exploring tapestries. We started exploring stained glass. Different elements that have been deconstructed in some way and reconstructed some other way.
My name is Bailey Parkerson. I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. We're kind of getting away from a flag in general, and we're looking for a symbol that embodies the modern South. Flags are for battles and quilts are for homes. And so this quilt concept, it's pretty powerful because it's used in all types of cultures. And also just the symbolism of multiple pieces all brought together, taking pieces of the past and pieces of the present.
But Alexander Flores, who's from South Texas, knows that trying to impose a symbol from the top down is not going to be easy.
I think it's something that should be more organic than, say, delivering a packet or something that says, here you go, here's your new brand guidelines for the South. I mean, I don't think it's that cut and dry. I think it's not so much about redesigning a flag, but reintroducing a new idea. And if anything, if we can start a dialogue, we'll be happy that we've contributed something more than just a logo.
We are going to check back in with the team at 70KFT in Dallas once they have pinned down their final design. In the meantime, let us know what you think at studio360.org. It's never easy to tackle a big creative project. It can be easier when you've got a lot of talented collaborators like the team at 70KFT. But what if you're trying to craft something all by yourself, just you facing a blank page or a white canvas? How do you bat away your doubts and overcome your hesitations and confusions and just make something? That is the big question Elizabeth Gilbert sets out to answer in her new book, Big Magic. You probably know Gilbert's name from her super mega ultra bestseller, Eat, Pray, Love, but she hasn't just been hanging out in Bali and gorging on pasta in the afterglow since. There was another memoir, a terrific historical novel, and now, with this new book, an essay meant to directly and practically inspire and help people. Liz Gilbert, welcome back to Studio 360.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
The subtitle of this new book is Creative Living Beyond Fear. And you talk in it about how you were this fearful little girl, mainly, it sounds like, animated by fear as a child.
I think it was an exceptionally kind of startlingly anxious, nervous, high-strung child. I vibrated a very high level, and it was super sensitive, and I was the last kid to learn to swim, the last one to come out from behind my mom's legs, the last one to go into the classroom. Everything terrified me. And I had the great good fortune of being raised by my mother, who was just this, you know, Scandinavian Midwestern farmer's daughter who just wasn't having it. There was something about that that she just rejected. And she wasn't going to raise a little candy ass. And
right.
And I think truly it came from a fear of her own, which was that she had seen through enough years of living that bad things happen to women who are scared and waiting for someone to save them, really bad things, and that it was important for her to raise daughters who could sort of look after themselves in the world. And so she fought it.
And what about people reading your book who want to do creative things and be like you, but who didn't have the good luck to have been raised by somebody like that? What, somebody's just like, oh, God, I am racked with fear. How do I get over it?
The sort of life hack, to use a an overused word at this point, that I use with fear is to, you know, just take a moment and show a little gratitude toward it, to just say, you know, thanks for all the times you've actually legitimately saved my life.
Yeah.
Because all of us are still alive, because at some point in all of our lives, our fear shut the thing down, whatever it was, said, you know, get out of the ocean. The waves are too big. You're not getting in the car with that guy. This is not a safe street for you to be walking down. I mean, our fear is vigilant about protecting us, and that's a wonderful service. But I have to have conversations with it constantly to explain, look, I'm really grateful for the times that you've physically and legitimately saved my life, but I don't really need your services right now, because all I'm doing is trying to write a poem and no one's going to die from it. You know, and that seems to help.
And that conversation is not like people who pray and have conversations with God, is it? Or is it for you?
Yeah, it is. It's a legit, like, out loud conversation that I have. And the thing is,
you're a nut, Liz. No.
Oh, it's a total screwball. And, you know, it is irrational, but only if you're, you know, 100% rational person, in which case my condolences.
So when you talk about magic in this book, that is not just a poetic turn of phrase. You actually genuinely believe that there are magical forces at work in your creative life, like little invisible fairies floating around.
Yeah, I like to imagine ideas as these disembodied life forms that have no form, but they have will and they have consciousness, and they spend eternity circling the earth looking for collaborators, going from person to person. Are you my mother? Are you my mother? Are you my mother? Like, just looking for someone to work with to bring them into the real out of the unreal. And I can't tell you how many projects I've been able to finish because of this sense that, look, this idea came to you, Liz, because it thought you could do it, right? So just believe in the idea. Otherwise, it would have gone to Barbara Kingsolver, you know? It came to you. It came to you because it wanted to work with you. So trust, trust, trust. So there's, like, to me, it's more playful and it's more kind of life-affirming in a way, and spirit-affirming to do it that way. And then I can go back to, like, believing in vaccinations and evolution and and being a totally reasonable human being.
Well, no, and I'll tell you, I want listeners to know that if they are more towards, say, my supernatural end of the spectrum, they should still read this book, because They can read it as I did, more as a metaphorical, poetic way of talking about these forces and inspirations that we don't really understand. And if she believes they're like fairies, fine. What she's saying still makes sense.
Thanks, Kurt.
Now, I know this book is pitched to everyone and that no doubt millions of people who will buy it. But do you really actually believe that everyone has, quote, hidden creative treasures that deserve expression? Because I'm not sure I believe everyone does.
I'll tell you the truth, Kurt. I don't know. Maybe. You know, and how are we to know unless people sort of right. give a swing to it? And you know, one of the things I'm not interested in, one of the things that doesn't fascinate me is the idea of talent, because I don't know, like between the two of us, I don't know how much natural writing talent I have. And I know that I've seen that I've loved people who I thought were immensely more talented than me. And I know that they didn't do their work. And we all know, you know, brilliant people who for some reason, you know, shut down or never even embark on taking the risks and doing the labor of creativity. And I also know, and you know, people who we dismissed, you know, and thought were kind of no one and nothing, and then they shocked us by
you and I are probably those something. People for other people.
I am definitely that person. I you know, like every review of The Signature of All Things was like, I can't believe that Eat, Pray, Love lady can write,
and she can. That was a great novel. Your main character in it, by the way, is a woman who is plagued by her own perfectionism.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you think perfectionism is more of a problem for women than it is for men.
You know, I'm terrible at solving huge social problems. But I will say, and I'm couching this by saying this is all very anecdotal. I will say that in my experience, speaking with a lot of women, and I do spend my life engaged with a lot of women who come to my events or who I see on social media, it does seem to be a really big problem for them. It does seem to be harder somehow to release that work into the world. And I'm constantly telling women, look, putting forth work in the world that's less than perfect never stopped men. and I don't necessarily even mean that as an
insult
to men.
Don't tell them that.
But, you know, like, look around, you know, yeah. like there's a lot of half-assed stuff out there that's not, it's half-assed, but it's also not half bad.
Yeah.
We all start our projects, whatever they are, on day one with the same feeling of excitement. And on day two, we all look at what we did on day one and we all hate ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like, that's universal. And most people stop there. And if you can continue to sort of just say, look, I'm doing my best.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to stay with this. You'll be able to work and you'll be able to finish things and you'll be able to produce. So
good. So you admit that persistence and tenacity and grit and sticking with it are essential. It's not all about making love to the inspirational angels.
Most of it's not about making love to the inspirational angels.
you have talked about your admiration for the historical novelist Hilary Mantel, who wrote, of course, the Wolf Hall series. She was here earlier this year, and she said something about her creative process that reading your book reminded me of, and I wanted to play a clip of her.
I mean, thinking about Thomas Cromwell for 30 years, almost ever since I began writing, I had it in the frame as a really good subject. And you wait for someone else to do it because it's so obvious. And as I saw the 500th anniversary of Henry's accession approaching, I thought, well, you know what? Nobody's done that yet. It's time I got to it.
God, I love her. God, that voice.
I know. Ugh. Have you ever had an idea that you've had in a drawer and in a computer file for decades and finally get around to doing it?
This one.
Oh, really?
This one. This book, Big Magic, I've been thinking about, actively thinking about writing for at least a dozen years. And I've been living by its principles and thinking about the ideas in this book for ever since I was a teenager. So
before Eat, Pray, Love, you were thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that you have finished this book some time ago, are you consumed with some new one?
I am actually, yeah. I'm writing another novel. I'm writing about New York City and the theater world in the 1940s, and about promiscuous girls, which has been really fun because My poor protagonist of my last novel was so buttoned up. By the time I was done with it, I was like, I got to write. I got to let some people have some fun in my next book. Oh. So this will be a little bit more of a romp. So, yeah, that's what I'm up to now.
Well, I theoretically own a bathroom sink that was used by multiple Barrymores. So if you need to do research, just come over and use my sink sometime.
Wait a minute. Back it up.
That's all I know. It's a guy. A house was built years ago by a playwright who also worked on demolishing theaters and as a day job, and took this sink. And when I bought the house, there was a little sign explaining its provenance. So there you go.
Multiple Barrymores is one of the best expressions I've ever heard. It's like we need to find a collective noun for what a
group like of Barrymores is.
A shot of Barrymores, a flask of Barrymores.
Yes, exactly.
I think is all the Barrymores together. That's fantastic. Well, I may come over and use your sink and see if I can get some angelic inspiration.
You're welcome to do so, Elizabeth Gilbert. This has been a pleasure, as I knew it would be. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt. It's always a delight to talk to you.
Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear is out momentarily. There's a wonderful anecdote in Liz Gilbert's book about a playwright who's got serious writer's block. He is sure he'll never write anything again. Then one day, one of his daughters asks him to paint her bicycle. The playwright becomes totally absorbed in that project, painting hundreds of tiny silver and gold stars all over the bike. When that one's done, he starts painting bikes for other kids in the neighborhood. Working with his hands eventually frees up his mind, and pretty soon, his writer's block vanished. Well, we've got a project kind of like that for you. Something to free up your mind and put your hands and fingers to good use. Nick Offerman, who played Ron Swanson on the late, great Parks and Recreation, is a very funny actor, but he's also a master woodworker. And he's challenging Studio 360 listeners to make him something awesome out of wood. Here is the catch. Actually, as far as I'm concerned, it's the best part. You can only use one kind of wood, popsicle sticks. Nick Offerman, it is great to have you here.
Thank you kindly.
Ron Swanson was also on the show a carpenter, so I guess you were secretly using the show to promote your woodworking agenda.
Yeah, my lifelong ulterior motive is, how can I get people to buy my tables?
There you go.
Well, get on an NBC comedy. the writers thought that my woodworking, I am an unabashed geek and nerd for it. And so they thought that was great fodder for comedy. And so Ron's shop is my own shop. We shot the show at my shop. And things like Ron's canoes that he built, those are my own canoes that I built in my shop. And
That's impressive, building canoes, all that curviness, and it can't leak.
Well, thank you. It's not as impressive as you would think. I often encourage people to give it a try, because if you break it down to one step at a time, that's one of the beautiful things about woodworking is it's just a series of problems that need solving.
You should be president, you know that. You're a plain-spoken, eloquent fellow.
I don't have a funny enough hairdo, apparently, to be president.
Yeah. And how many popsicle sticks should they use? I checked on the internet, and I see they cost between 2 and 4 cents a piece, which is not much, so they could get 100 for the price of a cup of coffee. But should they limit themselves, or the sky's the limit as far as you're concerned?
I say the sky's the limit. I mean, you know, perhaps someone will emulate the American Corn Palace of Mitchell, South Dakota.
One of the first amazing places I ever visited as a three-year-old child, one of my earliest memories.
I'm crazy about the Corn Palace. Yeah. If you haven't been, turn off the radio.
Yes, go.
Put it on in the car and go.
Yeah.
But, you know, woodworkers and crafters, that's what I love about making things with one's hands is instead of spending the time playing a game on your phone or just killing the lull in your day by scrolling through social media, take a popsicle stick and figure out what you can cleverly make out of it. I'm not the cleverest guy by any stretch, and so I am prepared to be pretty astonished by the kind of things that the breadth of your listening audience sends in.
You've only got until October 5th to enter Nick Offerman's Ultimate Popsicle Stick Throwdown, so get going. All the details are at studio360.org/madeForNick. Still ahead, the great and singular writer William T. Volman offers to take me on a shopping trip, as long as I drive, since he doesn't.
Well, let's go, you and me, and we will see what we can buy.
That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. William T. Volman has written a pretty astonishing number of books over the last three decades about an absolutely astonishing range of subjects, from the Cambodian killing fields to the U.S.-Mexico borderlands to the Fukushima disaster zone. His research has repeatedly put him in danger. Dysentery in Afghanistan, hallucinations at the North Pole, and he was the lone survivor of an attack in the Bosnian War that killed his two friends. There are method actors. Volman is the ultimate method writer. His books, fiction and nonfiction, tend to run long. And his latest novel, The Dying Grass, is more than 1,000 pages, not including appendices. Set in the Pacific Northwest during the late 1800s and historically accurate, the novel follows members of the Nez Perce tribe as they try to escape to Canada with the U.S. Army in hot pursuit. One of the raviest of the many rave reviews, this one in the Washington Post, called the novel the reading experience of a lifetime. And William T. Volman is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360, sir.
Oh, thank you so much.
I know you've admitted you read reviews. I presume you read that one. That's about as good as it gets, huh?
Yeah, that was a very nice review. I felt lucky.
The Dying Grass is the fifth novel in this seven-book series. You started this 25 years ago. All these books are about different moments and places of the European settlement of North America. What made you, in your 20s, conceive and commit and stay committed to such an immense project?
Well, I think that Indians, Native Americans, have always defined our sense of ourselves and our country in ways that are accurate and ways that are inaccurate. But when I was young, I remember looking at a parking lot in San Francisco and suddenly wondering what that place must have been like 100 years ago and sure. 200 years ago and 500. And I remember reading some of Audubon's journals, and he talks about how very, very quickly certain places have changed with settlement. And I thought, you know, I'd really like to be able to understand what our continent used to be like. I originally thought it was going to be one book with seven chapters. Now I'm 56, and who knows if I'll live long enough to finish them all. But the more I look into the history of our continent, the more fascinated I become.
There's a lot of, surprisingly, perhaps to a lot of people, there's a good deal of humor in this book. You do that to leaven the, oh my God, this horrible story, another horrible story of white people killing Indians. Or just because you like to write comically sometimes?
Maybe a little of both. I remember reading that there was a British officer who was observing, and he was utterly shocked and disgusted at how profane the American soldiers were. So I figured that gave me license to turn up the heat and throw in every possible cuss word I could think of and a few more.
you have written about and spent a lot of time with people at the various margins of society, homeless people and poor people and drug addicts and prostitutes. What appeals to you so much about their stories?
Well, I guess one answer might be that the more intensely people live, and often that means desperately, the more interesting their stories are,
yep.
at least to me.
Yep.
And maybe I would enjoy being a Jane Austen, but I'm just not.
I like the idea. And when you're hanging out with these people, as you have over the years, have you always been upfront about the fact that you're a writer and that they're material?
Not always. If I'm catching out in a freight train and, maybe I meet some hobo who's sitting on a piece of cardboard under an overpass and we're sharing a little bit of booze, he doesn't really care.
Yeah.
And it's not for me to tell
him. Right.
If I'm going to do anything substantial, then, yeah, I would tell people. And ideally, especially with the nonfiction, I like to pay for interviews. I always think that that is the ethical thing to do.
Did that idea of paying people come out of your research with prostitutes, where of course they expect to be paid, and did that give you the idea of paying other sources?
I think that helped me figure it out. You know, these street prostitutes wanted to be paid whether they were sleeping with me or not. And at first I thought, boy, you know, that's not very nice. I just want to be this person's friend. And then I thought, well, you know, what is sex or intimacy anyway, or whatever it is they're selling?
Having done that as much as you did, any regrets about that, or like, oh boy, I did that wrong, or I shouldn't have done that, or I was too into it, or is it no regrets?
Oh, the only regret is not enough sex with not enough prostitutes.
Huh. Okay. For some of your research, I read in the 1990s, you smoked crack, a lot of crack, like 100 times. Were you not worried about getting addicted?
People can get addicted to coffee or alcohol. I have never become an alcoholic. I can take or leave coffee, and perhaps it's not such a big stretch to take or leave other things.
Interesting. Now that you've been, as I read, with your wife for more than 20 years, and the two of you have a 16-year-old daughter, are the really dangerous adventures of which you've had so many behind you?
Oh, I hope not. You know, pretty soon my daughter will be out of the house, and I will be very, very sorry to see her go because I love her very much. But that means that I don't have to be so careful anymore.
Interesting. Speaking of adventures, 2 years ago for what you called the Book of Dolores, you wore women's clothing partly to try to understand the experience of women and transgender women.
That's right.
What did that give you in terms of understanding that talking to a lot of trans people wouldn't have given you?
I guess one of the things that I got out of it was a visceral understanding of the fear that many women experience when they go out alone at night. Because as soon as I put on high heels and breast forms and a wig and was tottering around without my glasses, I became a target. And I found it quite frightening and also quite humiliating. And I ended up having a lot more sympathy with the anguish and confusion and secrecy that envelops the lives of many trans people, especially the sex workers who, of course, are at the absolute bottom, have very little protection.
There's violence in lots of your books, and then you wrote this giant treatise on violence, 3,000 pages long, Rising Up and Rising Down. You also own a lot of guns and aren't shy about saying how much you love them and buy them before they're made illegal and all that. What do you like about guns and shooting and owning them?
To me, there's something uniquely special and American about our gun culture. For one thing, it's a way of saying, like it or not, the government kind of has to trust us to be our own masters. I'm not a hunter.
Do you carry them for self-defense?
Not anymore. And it might be that someday it would be possible to take away everybody's guns all across the world and there would be no violence from government or from people. And I might be okay with that. But we're certainly not living in that age now.
Given all of the dangerous and extreme and far-flung things you've done, the fact in reading about you that truly shocked me was that you don't drive. Is that so?
That's so, yeah. And I'm very happy not to drive. It's great for me. let my poor friends do the driving while I can chat with them and look out the window and take notes on the landscapes as we go
so,
by.
So you live in Sacramento, California. That's a driving place. How do you get around?
What do I need to drive for to go from one chain store to another?
Because it's a quintessentially American experience, and you love those quintessentially American experiences.
Well, let's go, you and me, and we will see what we can buy.
We'll do that. And you bring your guns. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
William T. Bowman's latest novel, The Dying Grass, is out right now. Thanks a lot.
Well, you are a nice person.
And finally, to end the program today, one guy's dream about the future of the New York City subway system, specifically what it ought to sound like. James Murphy is best known as the leader of the great band LCD Sound System, I Miss Them So, but now he's got another project he's trying to bring to life based on an idea he had years ago.
It was when my band was starting to travel around, because I had never really traveled before that, so this was a kind of like I kept experiencing my city new by going away. And I was on a metro in Tokyo. I noticed the sounds were quite lovely and gentle. And I was like, oh, how nice that they would do this. And I was in an airport in Barcelona, and they had this little three-note sequence that they give when they make announcements. Just goes boom, 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 which made me instantly nostalgic for my childhood, because there was a song that I didn't listen to after my childhood but was really common on the radio called Color My World by Chicago that started with the boom, 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 boom. And so it got me kind of like passively thinking, well, what if New York City subways sounded nicer? What if the sound, what if the tone was just a prettier tone? We just picked a different sound. What if each station had a little three or four note call melody that would be different? So each time when you're on a train, each time they announce the subway stop, they would just give a little four note sequence and you'd be that, you know, okay, that's my station. And so I kept developing it. It's like, this is a wish and a dream, like when they do something, when they do something. And then when the switch of the payment system was announced, like, well, they're going to have to now take every turnstile and pull that swipe track off and put something new in. I became more like, okay, I got to do this now. This is the only time to have it happen when that happens. My idea is that each station would have this little four-note sequence. And then there would be eight possible notes for each swipe. Each swipe is a random little generator. It's not totally random. It's a weighted generator. The most likely notes would be those four notes that comprise the melody of the station, with the root note kind of being the most common. So it would most commonly make a very simple chord. You may never hear the same thing again. Sometimes there'll be a cluster of four notes because people go through at the same moment. Sometimes it'll be like a bunch of staccato. Sometimes it'll be like languid, one note at a time, because people, it's not that active. It really depends on how many turnstiles, how busy it is. It's constantly changing. It sounds funny, but this didn't come from an art thought. It was much more like, I have an idea to make this thing that's happening happen more nicely. And all of it technologically, I kept thinking, well, it's just a beep. Like, it's such a simple tool that's already kind of there. There is already a sound. I don't plan on making all the notes at all. I have that's not my goal. I'd much rather have the notes be picked by a bunch of different composers in the city, like whether it's Laurie Anderson, Philip Glass, and DJ Premier, and I don't know, like a bunch of kids from a really good music public school program to like compose a bunch of it. People are, I think, very proud of where in the city they're from. I feel like you'd have those tones in songs as a way of saying, as a way of locating yourself, the way that people use their area codes. I think in 20 years, people will grow up and be like, this is the sounds from where I came from. This just becomes the part of the fabric.
So far, the people who run the New York City subway system don't seem so interested in James's plan, but that hasn't stopped him. And you can read more about the project at subwaysymphony.org. Jack Desidoro produced our story. That is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Well, And keep in touch with us during the week. We've got new stuff every day at studio360.org. And I'm on Twitter at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Louis Mitchell,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Emil Klein,
Elizabeth Kulas,
Caroline Lester,
Tommy Bazarian.
Special thanks this week to Hannes Brown and Q2 Music. And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
A songwriter got a call from a TV executive commissioning him to write a new theme for the NFL, but the executive had a strange idea of how the music should sound.
He thought the NFL theme should be like a Batman on steroids kind of sound to it.
Behind the Music NFL Edition, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.